Hey, I'm going to talk about the big one, enlightenment. Are you interested? Why? Let's call spiritual materialism again. That's a trouble. When something big prize is on offer, we want. And that's one of the terrible things about talking about enlightenment. As soon as you talk about it, either people want it, or they argue with you. No, that's not right. But nevertheless, it's a good thing to spend a nice morning just talking about enlightenment. And of course, you have to talk about it. It's the elephant in the room. It's, you know, as they say, it's a thing which people, you know, what you're here for, what you're Buddhist for, to become enlightened. But what the heck is it? And in all the time which I've been a monk, before I was a monk, even a Buddhist, before I was a Buddhist, before I was just a person looking for a path, I too was always interested in trying to find out what the purpose and goal of this life is. And so I remember, you know, when I started to get interested in religion was at school. You know, because somebody told me this, it's a very believable little quote I got from my psychologist, who said that people start becoming spiritual around the age of 15 or 16. Boys and girls were not just interested in sex, they're actually interested in finding out some meaning in life. And I certainly, when I heard that, I said, yeah, that was me. About that age, I started getting really interested in religions and the, you know, meaning of life and spirituality. And most young people are. Sometimes they don't talk to the adults because they don't believe what they're saying is true. But they certainly discuss with each other spiritual things. And certainly that was the case with me. The school I got scholarships all the way in my life, came from a very poor home. But the school which I went to, high school, you know, through a scholarship, was quite a good school. It had its own chaplain. So I went to see the chaplain one day, and I said, look, come on, you know, this God, it's really confusing. What is God? Can you explain it to me? And I remember, I'm not sure exactly what this priest said. He was an Anglican priest. He said something like, it's the unfathomable. It's the ground of all being. It's the Alpha and Omega. It's beyond words. It's the beginning and end of all things. And because I was, even at that time, interested in science, I wanted a definition. You know, something you could actually understand. Now, the Alpha and Omega, what the heck does that mean? You know, apparently it's Greek for the A to Z. So I thought, oh yeah, so that means that God is a street directory. It's not a street directory. The beginning and end of all things. Now what does that mean? Well, the ground of all beings. Now anything, I know what the ground is, you know, you do building. I know what the ground is you put the foundations in. I know what the ground of, you know, this monastery is, you know, the earth. You know that, you can touch it, you can feel it, you can see it. What the ground of all being, what the heck does that mean? And in the end, with all these descriptions, I left that priest firmly under the understanding that guy didn't know what he was talking about. And that was actually, I even understood that if you know what you're talking about, you can explain it in simple words. And since that time, you know, when I went to Cambridge and became a theoretical physicist, I remember one of the quotes of one of the great theoretical physicists, which you all know, Heisenberg, Werner Heisenberg. He made this great quote about quantum physics. Now, you may think that quantum physics is very complicated and weird and very hard to explain. But he made this quote while he was in England. He said, if you cannot explain quantum physics to the barmaid in the pub, you don't understand it. And I thought that's an amazing, profound quote. If you really understand something, you can explain it to anybody. That's one of the signs you understand things, that your ability to explain it. And there's a great quote from Werner Heisenberg. And I thought, well, that was actually true. That priest didn't know what he was talking about, because he couldn't really explain it in sort of detail. So later on, you know, I gave up Christianity, became a Buddhist, because that sounded interesting. And I didn't have really the God idea, but instead of the God idea, they had this enlightenment idea. So one day I remember going to see one of the monks in the Thai temple in Wimbledon in London. No, it wasn't in Wimbledon in those days, it was in East Sheen in London. So I asked him, you know, what is this Nibbana? Explain it to me. And he said, it's the unfathomable, the ground of all being. the beginning and end of all things. You get the joke. I've heard that before somewhere. And so I came to the conclusion he didn't know what he's talking about. Which is very true. So, you know, someone asks you, what's Nirvana? Can you give them a good explanation? If it's just like your mother, you know, who has never been to a Buddhist temple in her life, and say, you know, darling, what have you been doing all this weekend? Oh, I've been, you know, aiming for Nirvana. Well, what is Nirvana? Can you give a clear understanding your old mother can understand? Probably not. Why? Because you don't understand it either. So look at your predicament. You're giving all this time, all this energy, all this money to get to Nirvana when you don't know what the hell it actually is. It's like getting on a bus, not knowing where it's heading, not knowing the destination. Isn't that the most craziest things? So it's really good, at least you have some idea of what enlightenment is, Nirvana is, so you can actually understand it. At the very beginning, so if you don't want to go there, get off the bus quick. So I was very happy when you met monks like Ajahn Chah, who could actually give you good explanations. Who could actually tell you something which you can get your head around, you can understand it. Or even better, when you started reading the Buddhist texts. Because sometimes you read sort of monks, even me, yeah, I mean, that's what Ajahn Brahm says. You know, that's what Ajahn Chah says. That's what the Dalai Lama says. That's what this monk says. That's what that nun says. What did the Buddha say? And you always go, please, 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 when you study Buddhism, always go back to the Buddha. You know, that's the benchmark. If anything I say doesn't fit in, please tell me off. Discard what I say. Because what Sinha's teachings is perhaps the only real accurate thing you can rely upon. So what did the Buddha say about enlightenment? And he gives these wonderful, beautiful descriptions, which you can understand. And perhaps the best description is the paramang sukhang, the ultimate happiness. Because that's something you can understand. You can understand happiness. You've had happiness from time to time. Maybe you even had some during this retreat, maybe. At breakfast and lunch. Maybe not other times, but at least then. So you've had some happiness during this retreat. And there's been very deep happiness and great happiness and not so good happiness. There's been extreme happiness, moderate happiness and no happiness. So you know there are different levels of happiness. And that gives you an idea, just by extrapolation, what Nirvana is. So one of the things I ask people, and it's a great way of developing some insight, what's the happiest you've ever been in your life so far? What was your happiest moment? And when you look back, maybe you have a couple or a few. When you look back, what's your happiest moment? Then ask yourself, why was that happiness? What did it taste like? Why was that more happy than other things? And you'll find that the happiest moments are the moments where there's the least amount of self, the least amount of wanting, where there's some sort of perception of perfection, where you're totally content and at ease in that moment. And for many of you, it's not seeing the birth of your first child. It's not falling in love and getting married. It's not sort of, you know, winning the lottery, or your football team winning the grand final World Cup or something. Many of you, the most happiest moment in your life is something deeply spiritual. A time of peace, a time of deep stillness, a time of being one with the whole world and everything. Moments where all your desires totally fade. I ask people to remember that. Because if you can remember that, it gives you an understanding of what enlightenment could be. Take that experience and magnify it. See if what would happen if you were more content, more still, more at one, more at peace. And it gives you something that you can understand what enlightenment is. The ultimate of those sorts of feelings. Not only is that a very good reflection, when was my most happiest time? It's also a great thing we can find insight. Why was it the most happiest time? What did you actually get, you know, to have that achievement? Was there any material acquisition involved? And you'll find that material acquisitions had nothing at all to do with that moment of deep happiness. It wasn't just, you know, paying off your mortgage and now I've got my house, the bank doesn't own it anymore, I do. You know, it wasn't sort of getting another member of your family. It wasn't sort of getting the honour or the award or the degree. It had nothing to do with getting things. Remember, happiness has nothing to do with acquisitions. You'll find that happiness, where did it come from? It was always some burden, some irritation, some striving, some wanting, now it vanished. And you were free, at ease, at peace. And those most happiest times of your life, it's like you've just come to some sort of home. Oh, if only this could be my home for the rest of eternity. Now, you can get a lot of insight and understanding about Buddhism by reflecting on your most happy experience, deeply happy experience so far in your life. But also you can use that in your meditation practice. It's one of the skillful means which I use. Sometimes you're sitting there and you're bored, you're dull, nothing's happening. How can I start something happening? So you sit there, you close your eyes, sit down, get yourself comfortable. When your body's comfortable, you recall the most deeply happy experience of my life. And then you fill in the details. Where was that? Where was I sitting or standing? What was the location like around me? Was it trees or was it walls in a cave or in a mountain? What was the weather like that day? What were the people around me like? What was I wearing? What time of day? What season? Because every time you fill in a detail, you're reinforcing the experience. So filling in the details only serves a function of making that memory of your most happy experience so far in your life more solid. And you do that for 1 or 2 minutes, filling in the details and thereby sustaining this memory of the most happiest time you've ever had in your whole life. And then you let that memory go. The details vanish, but the feeling of peace persists. And then you go off meditating from that point, and you have a wonderful time. It's like you get a huge advantage in the race. You know, you're a couple of miles ahead of everybody else, simply because you've got the perception of this beautiful happiness, born of letting go, born of peace. So that's a very skillful meditation tool to use. Try it today. You've already had some peaceful, happy experiences. Remember them, fill in the details, sustain the awareness on that most happy experience. And then when all the details disappear, it's there. You've got this peace, this stillness, this happiness, and the mind just wants to go with it. And who knows, you may take it even deeper. So that gives you something you can understand about what Nibbana really is. And again, it usually is. If it's, you know, valid, deep happiness, a sense when things are missing, it's not a happiness which depends upon things. Most of the happinesses of our world depend on having the right people around, the right food, the right environment, the right weather, the right TV program, the right movie, whatever. But these are happiness which are independent of all those things. It's a sense of freedom. You don't need things to maintain that happiness. It's just there for you. Now again, when you keep reflecting on this, you've got some understanding of what Nirvana is. But to understand why it's there, what it actually is, understand its causes, get some idea of, you can almost define it, you can explain it to yourself so you can explain it to others. So what actually is that peace, the ultimate happiness? And I can't resist telling a story which I suppose most of you have heard before, the kids playing the wishing game. It's a beautiful description of Nibbana, perhaps the most easy to understand. And if you have an old granny or a friend, and they, or you know, people you work with, have got no idea what Buddhism is, and then sort of they said, "What is Nibbana?" this is the explanation I recommend you give to non-Buddhists. So they get an idea of what you're up to here. And of course, when you can explain it to others, it also helps you understand for yourself what Nirvana is. And it's a very beautiful story, which I came across many years ago. It's simple, profound, and it just leads you in these very easy to understand steps to a very hard truth, which many people just don't get. But you get it this way. And it's a story of the five children playing the wishing game. First child, the wishing game goes like this. Every child has a wish. And the child who comes up with the best wish wins the wishing game. So the first child said, well, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a new Nintendo. Actually, I don't know much about, I should actually do some research, someone who knows about video games, first of all. What's the state-of-the-art top best video game right now? Anyone know? No, that's something. What? Gran Turismo. Gran Turismo 5. I think his mother better look, watch. Okay, so the first kid said, I want Gran Turismo 5. Where? Okay, that's a good wish. So the second wish, little girl, she's very, very smart, as many young girls are. And you always got an advantage when you hear somebody else, what they said. I was just answering an email earlier that I'm going to be conducting a marriage in Malacca next Friday. Now, after here, I go off to overseas. And the bride-to-be was asking me, sort of, you know, when the marriage vows, actually, who gives the marriage vows first? You know, does a girl give her vows first and then the boy? And because she wrote to me, I said, look, it's best the boy gives his vows first of all. Then you can adjust your vows accordingly. Never be the first. Anyway, so the second girl in this wishing game, she had a bit of a chance to think, so she got a much better idea. So she said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a video game store. That's obviously better than just getting one video game, because you own the shop. You actually can get whatever video games you want, whenever you want them, because you own the store. And so that was obviously a superior wish than just one video game. And the third child, this was a boy. He too was smart. He said, I can do better than that. You know, boys, even if they're very, very young, just they're into money. So he said, yeah, if I had a video game store, I'd have $1 billion. When I told the story last time, I'd say $1 billion US, but apparently the Australian dollar's worth more now. So he said $1 billion Australian. Because he said, with $1 billion, I can buy my own video game store. So I like video games too. But he said, you know, the trouble with having video games is your mother never lets you have enough time to play them. She always tells me to do my homework. So after I bought my own video game store, you know, I'd have heaps of money left, I'd be able to buy my own school. Because if I own my own school, I don't need to set myself homework. And because I'm the boss of the school, I can still always give myself good grades. So every year I'll come top of the class in the school, and I can spend all day playing video games. And once I graduated from my own primary school, then I'll flog that, sell that, and buy a high school. You've got many private schools these days. So because I own the school, again, I can always give myself top grades. And even if people don't believe that I've got those top grades, I've got the piece of paper there. And anyway, when I finish high school, I can sell that and buy my own university. And that way, I won't need to go to school. I can play video games all the time. And if there's something else I think of that I need to buy, you know, $1 billion is a huge amount of money. Basically, you just won't be able to spend that in your whole life. So it was more money than he could ever use, the $1 billion wish. And obviously, that was winning. And there were two more children left. And if people haven't heard this before, I always like to pause and, you know, ask people to think, you know, what would be better than, you know, more money than you could ever spend? A better wish than that. Because for most people, that's the end of their wish. Winning the lottery, and then I'm happy ever after. You know, $1 billion, that's all I need, that's all I want, and then I'll be happy. But there were two wishes which were much better than that. And the first wish, which was better than that, this girl, again, very, very smart, She said, well, if I had a wish, I would wish for 3 wishes. Which is a wish. And my first wish I'll have in my video game store. The second wish I'll have $1 billion. And for my third wish, I'll have 3 more wishes. That way I can go on forever. And of course, that was an infinity of wishes. And that was obviously better than 1 wish of $1 billion. So there was the girl with the infinity of wishes, number 4. And there was still 1 child left. And the last child would win the wishing game. Because that boy sat down there and said, I can do better than that. My wish would be that I was so content I never needed any wishes. I was so content I don't need wishes anymore. And everybody agreed that was higher and more superior than the infinity of wishes. There's a really brilliant story because it takes you step by step on what people aspire to in this world. You know, first of all, in this world you just aspire to the ordinary things you enjoy. Then you get smarter, you want more. Then you want more. And once you have your $1 billion, not $1 billion, you want power. Power to get whatever you want, whenever you want it. The infinity of wishes, which is what most modern people want and aspire towards. To get whatever you want, whenever you want it. And that's what we call, I mentioned this before, the freedom of desires. Well, your desires and your wants are unencumbered. But there's no barrier between you and the pursuit of your dreams. It's the freedom of desires. The American dream. Get whatever you want, whenever you want, have it. Now that, for many people, is the goal of our societies. To create a government and society with enough wealth and freedoms and abilities and health so you can have your freedom of desire. To come and go wherever you want. To entertain yourself. If you want to be gay, great, be gay. If you want to sort of do this, go off and do that. You're not harming other people. Your freedom of desires. And the last child saw much deeper than that. That was the Buddha. The freedom from desires. Being so content, you don't need anything. No more wants. Now, even though you may not be able to achieve that, you can even see that. You know it's what it's going to be like. And I relate that freedom of desires to those experiences you've had in your life so far, which you call the most happiest. One of the most salient features of the happiest experience you've had so far in your life was a total freedom from desire. Just content, just happy to be there, at peace. And that gives you another understanding of what nirvana is. Enlightenment. Freedom from desires. You just don't need anything. You're just happy to be here. Now, you can understand also why we practice in this particular way of letting go, just being content, just being here, not wanting anything. What I've taught you all week is just trying to taste enlightenment, trying to understand that that is the way to peace. If you tried your freedom of desires to find skillful means, find some technique so you can get what you want, in this particular case, nimittas and jhanas. You know, you want to find Ajahn Brahma, I haven't got nimittas yet, how do I get it? I haven't got jhanas, please give me a trick, please give me a technique, there's only a day to go, please, please, tell me how I can do this. All I would be doing there is encouraging what you think is your freedom of desires, to get what you want. And that's endless. But if I say, just don't want jhanas, don't want nimittas, just be content, this is good enough, let go, stop controlling, stop making, stop wanting. Then actually you're going on the path to nirvana. And you're getting a taste of freedom. As that was one of the words of the Buddha. He said, when you let go, it's a taste of freedom. At last, I'm not being pushed and pulled around anymore. I can be content. I'm free from desires. I always thought that the desires were the tool by which I could get happiness. And now I understand the desires of itself are what prevents me being happy. So I'm going to get free from desires. And then your happiness which desires promised you, now you have. When you follow desires, they promise so many things. But as one monk a long time ago put it, all your desires are unfaithful to you. They promise you so much that when you get that, then I'll be happy. But they're unfaithful to you. Because as soon as you get that desire, you want another one. It's like marrying a beautiful woman, and as soon as you get married, then you want another woman. That's what desires are like. Figure it out. So, freedom from desires is what nirvana is. Understanding that, this is what the Buddha said, it's the freedom from craving. But also, when you get a freedom from desires, it's not just freedom from wanting, it's also freedom from hating and ill will as well. Because this ill will, this frustration, this anger, this negativity, is always just the flip side, isn't it, of wanting. You know, either you want something there in the future, or you don't want this right now. When you don't want this right now, that's called ill will and hatred. When you want something in the future, that's called craving or wanting. It's the same force. And how many of you really sort of got upset, spoiled your day because, you know, you got negative, ill will, I don't like this, I don't like that, I want it to be different. All that sort of anger and ill will, where does that ever get you in life? It just drives you crazy. That's why in Buddhism we call ill will craziness, craziness. There's the old story, which I love this story, because it gives me a chance to act out and have a bit of fun. It was a story of the man who had an afternoon off work, and his wife was cooking dinner, and he said to her husband, "Darling, I've run out of eggs. I need some more eggs." Just like sometimes Bianca does that when she's cooking. "I need some more eggs. Danny, can you please go to the shop and get me some eggs? I need this." But anyway, this was her husband who was off work and said, "Please, can you get me some eggs, darling?" And he said, "Sure, darling. But you have to give me some assistance. I've never been to the market before. I don't know what to do." So the wife gave him a basket, some money and instructions, and off he went to the market to buy some eggs for his dear wife. He was quite happy until he got into the market, because then this young boy came up to him and said, "You're so ugly. You're more ugly than the back of a camel." And, you know, even actually the front of the camels. Camels are some of the most ugly creatures. But even actually more ugly than that, have you ever seen a real bat? You know, they're one of the ugliest creatures in the whole world. Maybe that's because they sit upside down, I don't know. But anyhow, they're really, really ugly. And I remember this poor monk, he told me this in Thailand many years ago, in this very rough area of the northeast. The northeast of Thailand is already very rough, but this is one of the rough areas of the northeast, the sort of place that other northeasterners don't like to go to. That was, you know, the place called Kamsa'i at the time. And when he went on arms round there, he got a bat's head in his bowl. You know, with his rice. Sticky rice and a bat's head. Now, I've had sticky rice and frog, that's bad enough. But sticky rice and a bat's head is just, you know, takes disgustingness to another level. Because he said he opened his bowl after the arms round, he looked in it and saw this ugly bat's head. "I'm not going to eat today." So bat's heads are really, really ugly. So let's say that boy said, "Actually, you're more ugly than a bat's head. And you stink. You smell. You know, you must be using dog shit deodorant." Now I really do try my best when I'm telling these stories, you know, to make it sort of interesting and gross. But, you know, I am a monk, and I don't actually hear, you know, the sort of the latest ways of putting people down and disgusting them and grossing people out. I'm sure that you can actually add much more gross things, which you probably heard yourself in the last week. But this young boy, he just totally grossed this guy out, called him all sorts of unfair names, upset him. And the worst thing about being told off is when it's in public, and everyone hears what they're saying about you. And he was so embarrassed. And he was, you know, he felt very angry too, because he didn't know this boy, never seen him before. Why is this boy picking on him like this? So he turned around and went home. As soon as he got in the door, his wife said, "Darling, you're back early. Have you got the eggs?" "No! I never want to go back to that stupid market ever again. People are so unkind and uncouth and uncivilized. Don't ever send me back there again. It's a terrible place. I don't know how you stand it. Anyway, I'm never going to go back there again. It's a awful place, a terrible place. Never, ever again. That's awful. Don't send me there back again." I don't know, is that what husbands really sound like when they're upset? They don't. That's what you think. Ask your wife. But anyway, he's really upset. And his wife just waits for him to calm down. And you know, sometimes you have to do the great way of calming people down is speaking slowly. And that's a good thing for you if ever you get really uptight during this meditation retreat. Walk slowly. Do some chanting slowly. This is what should be done. It really actually calms you down. It actually works. And if you're ever in a confrontation with a person, they're getting angry, you speak slowly. It's amazing how you can actually control the situation with a bit of mindfulness and skill. So anyway, this wife, you know, she spoke slowly and calmed the guy down and then asked what happened. He told about the boy and she said, "Oh, it's him. That poor boy hit his head when he was very young. He had an accident. And unfortunately, he suffered brain damage. He's crazy. And that poor boy, he will never be able to go to school and get a job. Probably won't ever be able to get married and have a family or have any career at all. His brain damage is crazy. So he just hangs, he's been hanging around the market for years like this. Sometimes he abuses me, then he abuses somebody else. But, you know, he's mad, he's crazy, so we don't bother about him." And as soon as the husband realized that he'd been scolded by a crazy guy, all his anger disappeared. All his feeling of wanting to take revenge or find justice totally vanished. And as soon as his wife noticed he was calmed down, she said, "Darling, I still need those eggs." I don't know why that always gets a laugh when I say that. "I still need those eggs." They said, "Okay, and don't worry about that boy. Okay, I won't. He's crazy." So he went back into the market, got scolded and abused by the boy again. But this time it didn't matter. Why? Because the boy was crazy. And the moral of that story is, if you go home from this retreat and your husband, your wife start scolding you and calling you all sorts of names, you know, "You lazy, good for nothing, I've been working hard, you've been enjoying yourself, this is unfair," don't take it personally. Just assume that your partner's hit their head. For their brain damage. Because all anger is temporary insanity. It's a wonderful way of looking at it. Anger is temporary insanity. Because it's a waste of time getting angry. So, understanding that, we see other people angry, it's temporary insanity. If you're angry, it's temporary insanity. Because you want what the world can never give you. And that makes you frustrated. And sometimes somebody asks me that. Look, it's actually in Singapore, of course. They said, "Look, I haven't got much time." I'm in a rush, but can you please tell me what dukkha, what suffering is? Well, that's what I said. I actually rose to the case. I was very happy. Like most of the times I stuff up, but this time I got it right. And I said, suffering is wanting what the world can never give you. And they thought about that. I said, that's amazing. It's true. Bye-bye. It's true. How much do you want what the world can never give you? If you do, that's called anger, it leads to anger. Because instead of thinking that you're asking too much, you just beat up the world for not giving it to you. So really, when you understand just how that fifth child, this is good enough. I'm content. I want nothing. The freedom from wants. That's also the freedom from anger and ill will. And that gives a very wonderful way of understanding enlightenment. The freedom from desire, the freedom from anger. It's also called the freedom from delusion. And that's such a hard one to pin down. Because people come up and say, I'm not deluded, I'm right, it's you are wrong. You just don't see things properly. You know, you shouldn't be a monk, you're attached to the robes, come on, let go, find a girl. If you're gay, I'll find a guy for you. Come on, let go, enjoy the world, go watch the movies, Harry Potter, the latest episode is out. Enjoy, come on. Said, you're wrong being a monk. So you know what it's like all the time, everybody thinks they're right. So the idea of actually understanding enlightenment by wisdom is a very dodgy idea. Many people think they're wise. Many people think they see the Dhamma. So how can you know who's right and who's wrong? Are you right? Am I wrong? How can you find out? So actually, wisdom, being able to write good books, give deep talks, or say profound things, is no sign that you're enlightened. But the freedom from desire and the freedom from ill will, yeah, that certainly is a sign whether you're enlightened. So if anybody gets angry, sorry, you've got more work to do. If anyone is really greedy or got lusty, sorry, more work to do, you're not enlightened yet. But the easiest one is actually anger. So that's usually the classic thing. The classic test which we monks use if someone thinks they're enlightened, we've got to find out whether they're enlightened or not. We look at you and say, girls can't get enlightened. Only boys can. Are you upset and angry? If you are, you've got more work to do. That's not true. Girls can get enlightened, boys can get enlightened, everyone can get enlightened. But the point is, you try and upset people, trying to push their buttons, trying to make them, you know, angry. And if they do get angry, what's wrong with girls? Girls could become enlightened. You're just a misogynist monk. Said, no, that was just a test. You failed. Get back and see. The classic story, which, you know, I think it comes from Sun Po's work, was about this monk. And this monk was in this temple. It's a great story. It's a golden oldie. Many of you heard it before, but you know what it's like, golden oldies. You know, you hear this music often over and over. You go to your favourite movies again and again. So this is like one of Ajahn Brahm's stories again and again. But it's a lovely story about this was a monk who wanted to become enlightened. And so he said to his abbot, just look, I really, really want to become enlightened. I'm not messing around, okay? I'm not lazy. I want to do this. And to get enlightened, you know, I really do need some solitude. So he said, you know, to the abbot, he said, not far from here, you've got this beautiful retreat center. You know, can you just build me a little hut, you know, in the forest, in your retreat center? But I don't want to do any work or have any sort of difficulties. All I want you to do is just send one of the Anagarikas, the men in white, over once a week, just with some supplies. That's all. And then, I know, in the little hut, in the forest, I can just meditate. I don't need very much. Simple food is enough. And then I can meditate at peace to see if I can become enlightened. And, you know, what can an abbot, a senior monk, say if somebody really, really wants to do that? So he built him a hut, you know, in the forest, you know, not far from the monastery. And he sent this Anagarika over once a week with supplies. And if the monk needed anything, like batteries or some new sandals or something, he'd write it on a piece of paper and he'd give it to sort of the Anagarika. And the Anagarika would take it back, and the next week when he came over, he'd give the supplies, you know, more soap or toothpaste or something. And this went on for about 3 years. And during that time, that monk had seen no one, except for the attendant, had actually been meditating just so diligently. It was only after those 3 years he thought he'd broken through and he was enlightened. So what to do next? He had to somehow inform the abbot that he could now leave the hut because he was totally enlightened at Arahat. So how could he do that? So he asked the attendant one day, can you please send over some paper, some ink and a pen? I want to write some Buddhist calligraphy. So the next week it all arrived. And then, in his little hut in the forest, the monk sat down with the paper, the pen and the ink, and meditated. He got in this very deep meditation. And when he came out, his mind was clear. His hands were ready to write this amazing calligraphy. And I've seen some of this calligraphy, you know, in Malaysia and Singapore. And some of this calligraphy is actually hung on museums. These are experts. And there's one brush and it's sold for thousands of Singaporean dollars. I mean, that's how amazing it is. And this was actually a monk who just got enlightened. So imagine just how precious that calligraphy would be. And he wrote in his Chinese characters the following verse in four lines. The traditional in Buddhism, they have these verses in four lines. And the first line was, it translated as the diligent monk. The second verse read, silent for 3 years. And the third verse said, is no longer moved. And the fourth verse, by the four worldly winds. The diligent monk, sorry, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. And that is like a euphemism, you know, the sort of thing which other monks realize, that's the guy saying he's enlightened. And so he wrote that, and the calligraphy was absolutely exquisite. When it was dry, he rolled it up, and he gave it to the Anagarika to deliver to the abbot. A week later, the reply came back from the abbot. It was his own piece of paper with his own poem on it, which he spent so many years getting an attainment so he could actually write that with incredible, beautiful calligraphy. And as he looked at that piece of paper, the abbot had scrawled in red biro pen over the first line, the four letters F-A-R-T. Fart. And he was nonplussed, he didn't know what this abbot was doing. When he read the second line, this time the same four letters in capitals, F-A-R-T. The third line, in big capitals with an exclamation mark after it, fart! And the fourth line, it's no longer moved by the four worldly winds. A big fart, triple exclamation mark and underlined. And that was really it. I mean, sort of, you know, sometimes you wonder why people become abbots. You know, they're not wise. They just go there for you know, prestige or something, and, you know, to get the first choice of the food. And that stupid abbot, you know, not only did he actually spoil this calligraphy, this was a desecration of a work of art. I mean, that could have been hung in some great temple somewhere, and the biro pen, you know, like some graffiti artist. And that was it. He's not going to stand for that. You can't stand for abuse. We said that the other day. When you're abused, you've got to say something about it. You've got to speak up. So he managed to catch that Anagarika and got the Anagarika to take him out of the retreat place and go and see the abbot. And he went into the abbot's cave. And the abbot's office. And he slammed that piece of paper down on the abbot's desk and said, you can't do this. This is just not the sort of thing a monk should do, let alone an abbot. And you just can't understand enlightenment when it's in front of your big fat belly, you stupid abbot. He was very upset because, you know, when you're abused, you know, you got, well, maybe, have you got a right to be upset? But he thought he did and he was very upset. And of course the abbot was very, very soft and kind and smiled. And the abbot said, very good. That's actually not the story as Sun Po told it, but... And then the abbot opened up the piece of paper and said, okay, monk, this is what you wrote. The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. Yet, four little farts have blown you clean away from your heart to me. It's a beautiful story. No longer moved by the four worldly winds, but farts move you. So if you're going to test someone's enlightenment, you've got to be gross. That's why I practice with you guys. So he realized, the poor monk realized he wasn't enlightened after all. And that's what an abbot's supposed to do, you know, to sort of find out what you're made of, whether you've still got anger or not. So if you've still not got angry, you've got work to do. If you're not content, if you still want more things, then you're not content. If you still sit there with your eyes closed and want something, you don't know what enlightenment is yet. Remember, it's freedom from desires, not the freedom of desires. So if you want to be enlightened, the next time you sit, just sit there wanting nothing. Just being content. Just happy to be here, wherever that happens to be. And then you're on the path to Nirvana. If you want something, I want some lights, I want to see the Buddha, I want some insights, I want a lottery number. You know, I promised Ajahn Brahm last night, I gave him 10%. I want. How can you become enlightened that way? You are going in the opposite direction. But just develop contentment, being happy to be here, is a path towards enlightenment. In another story, which is a brilliant sort of explanation of this, I'll tell it in brief because you've heard it so many times, about that monk who used to go into prisons. And when asked how what they did in the monastery, he told just all of the stuff which we have to do there. And the prisoners, this was in Casuarina jail, realized there was far more ascetic in Bodhinyana monastery than in a prison. In a prison you get 3 or 4 meals a day. You get sort of far more choice than you get in a monastery, far more choice than you can get here. You can watch TV, you can play sport, you don't have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning in prison. So it was actually a very true comparison. The prison in Australia is far more comfortable than Bodhinyana monastery over the road. So why was it that there's so many people wanted to stay in Bodhinyana monastery? And why is it that so many people want to get out of prison? What is the difference between prison and freedom? It's only after that experience that you realize that a prison is any place you don't want to be. And freedom is any place where you want to be. That's why living as a monk in Bodhinyana monastery, yeah, it is ascetic. I sleep on the floor, got a little cave. But I'm so happy to be there. That's why I feel so free in that monastery. But any time I don't want to be there, I realize that's a prison. And somebody came up and told me this. They'd just come back from, I think, from Brisbane. They'd been in a conference. And somebody put them up in this hotel. It was a 5-star hotel. I think they said $300 a night it cost the organizers to put them there. And they hated it. They said they were in this sort of room and they have nowhere to go. They're bored watching the TV. And I remember that experience once. I went to this big conference, a big Buddhist summit in Japan. And the hotel room they put me into, I mean, was maybe 5.5-star. You know, it was Japanese style. They had a little place where you could, you know, like the little tea stall and a huge room and so many plasma screen TVs and stuff like that, and, you know, even in the bathroom. I couldn't turn any of them on, couldn't use the spa, couldn't use the minibar. And I was stuck there. And, you know, all afternoon I thought, I wish I was in a forest, you can go for a walk, you know, on some nice peaceful place where you can listen to the sound of the birds. And I realized I was making a prison of that room. I didn't want to be there. And that's why I hated it. And I realized, my goodness, Ajahn Brahm, you've made a prison out of a 5-star hotel. And that's actually this person who recently returned from Brisbane said that's what happened to them. They're in this $300 a night hotel. And because they hated it, they were in prison. You don't have to be in a sort of small cold cell with bars to feel what it's like to be in a prison. Any place you don't want to be is called prison. Now, do you want to be here right now in this room? If you do, you're free. If you want to be somewhere else, you're in prison. If you can't wait to get home, this now is a prison for you. Any place you don't want to be. You're in a job you hate. You're in a relationship which is very, very difficult for you. It feels like a prison, doesn't it? You're in a body which is aching and sick. You don't want to be here. Your body becomes your prison. And how do you escape from those prisons of life? Not by changing the government. Not by changing your husband. Not by changing your house or your job. There's only one way to be free. Wanting to be here. No desires. Then you're always free. You can't change the world, but you can change your attitude towards it and want to be here. And that was so helpful to people's meditation. Any time when you're meditating the next day, if you don't want to be here, you just got a dull mind, your dullness is prison. You've got a restless mind, you're thinking too much, you're in prison again, you're suffering. You don't need to stop the dull mind. You don't need to stop the restless mind. All you need to do is want to be here. Dullness. The door of my heart's open to you. I just want to be with you. Then you're free. There's no more problems. Restlessness all over the place. Yeah, that's good enough. I want to be restless. Like that story I said from 3 to 4 p.m. when I said, any sexual fantasy, any deviant thought, that's fine by me. And then my mind was so still. If you want to be here, you have instant freedom. You have a taste of enlightenment. You want to be somewhere else, and you're suffering. You're stuck in the wheel of samsara. Now that's what enlightenment is. But before, that was quick. Before I go on, there's four stages of enlightenment. The spring winner, once returner, non-returner, arahats. I've done that. Now. People say, well, please explain the stages of what enlightenment is, but how does it happen? And of course, like everything else, it happens gradually. First you get the kick up your bum. That's called the jhanas. So you see things in a different way. Things you've never seen before, like what contentment is. You say all these things, and you say all these things, and you say all these things, but still you don't understand. But one day, bang, it hits you. Oh my God, that's what he meant. And there's those great opening of the mind experiences. Sometimes you could keep banging on the same door, banging on the same door, banging on the same door, and one day it opens. And that's what happens. Because conditioning is such, you've been conditioned for so many lifetimes, it's actually hard to see these things of contentment. You say, no, come on, Ajahn Brahm, sorry, you've got to want to be content. No, you can't want to be content, you have to be content. You have to strive to let go. Let go takes a lot of training, a lot of work to let go. That's not letting go. You can't strive to let go, you let go of striving. So we say, okay, I'm going to do letting go. No, you don't do letting go. You let go of doing. And it's just so complicated that after a while that people get a bit frustrated, but one day they say, oh, I'm going to give up on all this Ajahn Brahm stuff. Exactly. Well done. You've got it. And then one day you actually understand, you see. And the greatest simile of this is from the Buddha, when he had told the story of the seven shipwrecked sailors. The first shipwrecked sailor is in the ocean, and because he's got bad karma, never given a donation to the retreat centre, always bad mouth the nuns, they go straight down, sink, like a lead weight. The second shipwrecked sailor, they've done some good merit, fed the nuns, but then they've also, written letters about them. Oh, they're okay, you know, just not that bad, but, you know, they've excommunicated a good monk. But, you know, they're really nice people and good teachers, and they're old friends. So those are the ones, go up, go down, go up, go down. they got some good, some bad. Now that's the second, the third shipwreck sailor. They're really, really good. So, you know, they've always and never excommunicated a good monk. They realise the importance of having bhikkhuni ordination in our world. They've always supported the Jhana Grove Retreat Centre. And they've always appreciated and said thank you to Ajahn Brahm for his wonderful jokes. These are the people with good karma. They float on the surface. So that's the third shipwreck sailor that got good karma. They always float. And of those, that group of third shipwreck sailors, the ones who float, because they got good karma, they keep in precepts and they've been good people. Sometimes they look and they see in the distance the shore. They see an island. They see land. They see a place where they can go to be safe. Now that's the stream winner. At last you see, yes, there is actually an end of this suffering, this wanting, this pain of never being where you want to be and always wanting something more. There's an end to that. They see the shore. When you see dry land, nibbana, the end of craving, understand what it is and why it is and how it is, then that's called the stream winner. That's the most important part. Just to understand what this is all about. Once you understand what it's all about, you see the Dhamma, the rest is automatic. That's why I say a stream winner at most 7 lifetimes. That's only for the really slow ones. But you know it's certain. Because if you're in the ocean, you stream dry land, what are you going to do? Start swimming for it. You don't say, should I swim for it, should I not swim for it? Should I just sit in here? Or should I try and live? Of course you go swimming for dry land. So once you've seen the Dhamma, you've seen non-self, you've seen freedom from craving, you've seen sort of real peace, you understand that most wonderful, peaceful experience of your life, why it was. Once you've tasted something like that, you can't forget it. You go swimming for the land. And one who's swimming for the land is called a once-returner. They're on their way. Soon you get so close to land, you know, when you're swimming, you don't need to actually swim anymore. You can stand up in the surf. You know, like just being by the beach, if you're going swimming. When you're close to the shore, you just stand and wade the rest of the way. You're almost home. And that's called the non-returner. The non-returner has totally given up any sort of craving or wanting for things of the 5 senses. But wanting for the things of the mind, the jhana, they still have wanting there, but it's just so tiny compared to the wanting in the big 5 sense world. They'll never come back as a human being again. There's nothing there to drag them there. There's no craving left in that place. But they still crave the delights of the mind. So they're not unsure yet. They're just waiting in the last bit of surf. The attachment, the craving to the pleasures of the mind. That's called the non-returner, the anagami. But it's such an easy thing to do, just to wade the rest of the way. Imagine what it's like swimming a couple of miles. That's really a lot of effort. But once you can stand, it's easy to do the rest of the walking. And that's the 6th shipwreck sailor, the one who's wading to the shore. And the last one is the enlightened one, the Arahant. They've made it to the shore. So they're sitting on the shore under the coconut tree with a big cup of condensed milk tea, drinking it, this is nice. that's the 7th shipwreck sailor, that's the Arahant. And that's a very beautiful explanation about the stages of enlightenment, you know, from the Buddha, because that gives a simile from his time which we can understand. So it's not gobbledygook, it's something which you can understand, which hopefully I've explained to you in a way which you get the meaning. So you understand what enlightenment is, what nibbana is, but also you understand how you get there. Because once you know what the goal is, you know what the path has to be. So you can't let go of craving by craving. You can't be peaceful through striving. You can't be free by wanting. You're free by letting go of wanting. You end craving just by being content right here. You end all of this agitation by being still. So you understand that the meditation is just the practice of enlightenment. Just seeing how enlightened you can be by how still you can be. How peaceful and how content. The more you are content, the more peaceful, the more still, the closer you are to enlightenment. The closer you are to a taste of freedom. So, there we go. That's enlightenment talk tonight. No Abhidhamma, no sort of words which you can't understand. Simple, direct, and hopefully meaningful. So, as the Buddha said, the doors are now open. Not the deathless to the kitchen, because you've got to go there for a meeting in a few minutes. So, enjoy and see what happens next. Thank you for listening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. As I said, there is now a meeting for you all. Would you please go to the dining room? And Bianca has something important for you to say to you, I think, about the arrangements for the rest of the retreat. Actually, I know something what she's going to say. Is that, you know, because people have really been enjoying this retreat, we've decided to extend it for another week. So no one will be allowed to go home until... So all your plans are gone. So just stay here. Maybe, but I don't think so. So anyway, have a nice meeting. And have a nice meditate for the rest of the day. Very good. Okay, off you go.